Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight and managing to get here despite the problem with Sydney trains this afternoon. It's great to have David Blunkett along at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him very briefly in just a minute, but I should also mention that the Right Honourable David Blunkett's visit to Australia has been sponsored by Vision Australia and the Australia and New Zealand School of Government, and we're grateful for them and for making it possible for David Blunkett to address the Sydney Institute this evening. We'll publish Mr. Blunkett's talk in the Sydney papers and we'll put it up on our podcast tomorrow. And I note that APEC Channel 607 is here from Sky News and they're very welcome. I'll introduce David Blunkett very briefly because he's well known to you, with a background in local government, as a senior politician in the Blair Labour government, New Labour in Britain, and still currently the MP for Sheffield Brightside, and of course the author of the Blunkett tapes, which is quite an insight into British cabinet politics and British politics in general. So it's a great honour that David Blunkett could find time to address the Sydney Institute during this, his first visit to Australia. And the topic for tonight is unfettered free market bad, public interest good? Why hasn't the global meltdown led to a resurgence of left of centre politics across the world? David Blunkett, you're very welcome.
Well, firstly, thank you very much indeed for the invitation and above all for being here, because if you weren't, it would be very lonely here up at the front this evening. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity of addressing the Institute and to be able to share a few thoughts, which I hope will stimulate discussion and debate. I think we all know that we live in a rapidly changing, rapidly moving world, which for many causes great instability and insecurity. For others, a sense that they're losing their identity and a sense of belonging. It's quite hard, actually, in the present world to pin down your own identity as easily as you would wish. A few years ago, I was elected to the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party in Britain, and it was at a time when we hadn't yet invented New Labour, and we thought being elected to our own bodies was tantamount to being elected to government. We were so pleased with ourselves. And I was walking along with my guide dog, and some people were coming towards me. It was at the annual conference, and I heard them saying, "It isn't. It is. It can't be." And my ego was rising, and as they came alongside me, they said, "Yes, it is. It's a curly coat retriever." took me down a peg or two. Actually, I haven't my identity stolen by the BBC. They managed to get a driving licence in the name of Frederick Forsyth, the author, and myself. Now, fortunately for the world, I've not chosen to use this driving licence. Given that I can't see, I would be a danger to everyone on the road. But I make the point because we are in a world where it's very difficult for people to feel that the old certainties are still with us. I think probably one of the examples that bridges the thousands of miles between the UK and Australia is the issue of immigration. I noticed the moment I arrived here this weekend that once again the opinion polls were testing whether the Rudd government was tough enough in relation to the boat people and the transit arrangements in Christmas Island. I noticed from the Sunday papers back home that another row has broken out in Britain about what happened 5 years ago in terms of the way in which several hundred thousand asylum seekers over a 10-year period had been handled, and we go round and round in circles on whether people feel that they're being literally swamped by changes to their culture, to their ethnicity, to the identity they feel. And I think what strikes me about that, and many other things that I intend to just touch on tonight, is how easily people can be disturbed, how quickly people can feel inside that those insecurities, those uncertainties, that rapid change is making the world for them a place that they don't feel as comfortable with as they did in the past. Some of it is a kind of nostalgia for a world which never existed. Sometimes it's for a world that did exist but wasn't anywhere near as stable and as comfortable as people would like to think. But it's added to, not just by what's happened with the global meltdown economically, but also what's happening with the global meltdown in terms of climate change, what's happening with the rapid change in information technology and the speed of communication, satellite, iPhone, the internet, changing what is available and what can be seen and heard and experienced literally at the touch of a button. And all of that brings into people's homes and into their lives things that would have taken time to reflect on, maybe would never have actually reached them, brings things into their home which make them feel a little bit disquieted, even when it's thousands of miles away. And I've experienced that combination of new technology and insecurity in the jobs I've had when I was the Home Secretary in charge of security and immigration, policing and much else. My opposite number was Nicolas Sarkozy, who, of course, as you know, is now the President of France, but at the time was Interior Minister. And we had an encampment at Calais on the French coast called Saint Gap, which was a magnet for people making their way across Europe to claim asylum in the UK. And we don't have a Christmas island, of course, to put people on. So they were desperate to get on the train, Eurostar, or the freight trains coming under the tunnel, or to get on a boat across the channel to England. And this camp was a major problem for both the French and ourselves. And I'd only been in post a very short time when I reached agreement with Nicolas Sarkozy that we could close the camp, but he wanted me to take several hundred Iraqi and Afghan potential asylum seekers, and we met at the French Embassy in London, and just before a dinner which preceded the formal events the following morning, he took me to one side and he said, "I want you to know, David, that I already know what your bottom line is in terms of the negotiations." And I sat for a moment and I thought I'd better call his bluff. I said, "What is it?" And he told me what my bottom line was. And I said, I presume that the French security services are working overtime. He said, "No, it's just simply that the people who were emailing from the Home Office here in London to your embassy in Paris didn't encrypt the emails." And I thought that was a giveaway in several respects. Firstly, how incompetent our people were, and secondly, that they were intercepting everything that was coming in at their end. And I did feel a little insecure and unstable at the time. And I use the example because actually we live in that sort of world now where people put material on Facebook without realising what it might mean. There's a true story of a mayor in the United States in a small town who put herself on MySpace in her underwear, and when there were calls for her to resign, she explained that she thought that MySpace was personal to her space rather than that it was going out. So we live entirely different lives than we did even 10 years ago. And the geopolitics that you experience here in Australia, and the nature of Australian society, the mention of immigration illustrates how concerned people are about cultural issues and about change here. All of that is underpinned in other parts of the world by the way in which the global meltdown has affected people's prospects of employment, the way it's undermined their certainties about what's happened to their investments, to their capital holdings, to the future of themselves and their families. You obviously have had an experience of a modest downturn, but nothing like what's happened in Europe or North America. And I hope it remains that way, because it will have helped not only in terms of people retaining their jobs, but also in terms of people behaving and thinking rationally about what's happening in the political and social arena around you. Because what's happening in Europe and North America is anything but rational in terms of the way people are responding. And I wanted to just talk tonight about why it might be that in a situation where the free market, particularly the operation of capital markets and the way in which the unfettered, unregulated operation of capital has actually led to the downturn and to the tremendous instability, why is it that it isn't right-of-centre politics and politicians who have been blamed or have been seen to have inadequate action to deal with it? Why is it that in Europe it is the centre-left who have, on the whole, little exceptions like Norway, although the left in Norway won the election with fewer votes than the right, just a quirk of their electoral system. But on the whole, actually, it is the left of centre politics that is taking a drubbing. And although Obama is in a different position because he was elected at the end of the worst of what was happening in the United States, the recent elections in Virginia and in New Jersey have actually seen a substantial swing to the right. So there is undoubtedly a trend away, and I'm very happy to answer questions and deal with discussion on what's happening in Britain. I believe that my Prime Minister took the right actions in terms of both getting people together through the G20, in terms of the global actions that were required, and in terms of our own economy. But there's no question whatsoever that we've got a mountain to climb if we are going to stand a chance of winning the general election, which really will have to be held by May next year. And therefore, in our own situation in the UK, as well as across Europe and North America, we've seen a reaction. And I just wanted to explore why I thought that was the case. I think historically, you look back across the globe, you see that when people are insecure, when there is instability, they tend to go for certainties, and they tend to look to people who actually are offering greater stability in other areas of their lives. So those who are seen to be tough on issues that worry people, that subliminally worry people, are the ones who genuinely benefit. In the past, it could have been far left as well as the right of politics, but with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc 20 years ago, and with the changes that have taken place, including in China, that isn't the case. Incidentally, one of the twists that was put to me just 5 or 6 weeks ago by the former finance minister from Sweden was that the decision of the Chinese to create greater marketisation within China, and the fact that people were expected to save and to develop their own income for retirement and investment in schooling for their children rather than relying on traditional state provision, led to the creation of investment portfolios which had to go somewhere, and very often went to the United States and underpinned the lending that took place in the US and the subprime mortgage fiasco that destabilized the world economy. I thought that was worth just passing on to you, because it's an interesting reflection about how one change just might, he may be wrong, but I thought he was quite convincing on the subject, how one change can actually lead to other domino effects, which then have a major impact on the way in which people perform and react elsewhere. In the United Kingdom, we have the upsurge of the British National Party, who are as near fascist as you can get in a modern setting, and who did extremely well in our European Assembly elections, although our election system for the European Parliament is different to our first-past-the-post in Westminster. It's not a system I'm comfortable with. It's a regional list system. And in my own region, they got a seat with just 6.4% of the vote. I think that is a distortion of democracy. But the upsurge of feeling and the reflection of that in the vote for the British National Party in Britain and their subsequent right to appear on major prime-time television discussion programme, Question Time, has actually put on the agenda what is it that people in Britain feel is so bad in their lives, so difficult, that they are once again prepared to turn to that sort of politics. Now, in Britain, and I don't think this is entirely true in Australia, people are extremely worried about insecurity on the street. They're worried about muggings and theft, even though burglary and car crime has gone down by over 40% in the last decade. And actually, overall crime is down by about a third. People still feel that in their lives. The post-11th September 2001 situation has led to people, again subliminally, being extremely insecure about the nature of the world around them and the threat, perceived or otherwise, in relation to terrorism. The debate we're having in Britain about our part in fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and the aftermath of our intervention in Iraq has created all sorts of uncertainties and, I believe, instability. I voted and would do so again for our intervention in both countries, in both Iraq and in Afghanistan, and I think we're right to do so. But we've not understood and taken measures to ensure social cohesion and social inclusion so that people can open their minds and hear messages which otherwise are closed to them. Because there's no point in asking people that I represent in my constituency to start discussing how we play a part on the global stage in terms of the restoration of the global economy or our intervention in protecting ourselves by tackling the Taliban, or the issue of climate change, or how we might actually be more open in terms of inward migration, when they feel their job is about to go from under them. They're in danger of not being able to pay the mortgage on their house, or that they won't be able to put money aside for the future of their children. You can't ask people to have the open mind and open heart that people here debating in this institute will have unless you actually settle and provide the substance of people's everyday lives. And I think that the left in politics have misunderstood that and have not necessarily always been prepared to acknowledge what needs to be done to get alongside people, to speak with people in the language and the issues that they themselves are concerned about, and to acknowledge those worries without pandering to them. And I mean, not all of you will agree, but I think that Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, who I'm meeting tomorrow, have done a really good job in the time that they've been in office here in Australia. And I don't imagine for a minute they get the full credit for it, but they're at least still to be, seem to be about 12 percentage points in front here. We would love to be back in that sort of situation. We got used to it. We got complacent about it. Even with the Iraq war splitting our country and my party down the middle, we still won a substantial majority in 2005. But we drifted away again from understanding those core issues. I just wanted to pose tonight that I think that one of the paradoxes of the moment is that the left in politics in Europe and North America have not been able to explain what it is that they are offering and why it is that it wasn't their politics that led to the current downturn and difficulty across the world. In other words, there hasn't been a narrative, there hasn't been an explanation that is so simple and understandable rather than complex and highfalutin that people can actually grasp that it's something to do with their lives rather than looking for someone to blame. We all look for somebody to blame in our own lives from time to time. It's never our fault, it's always somebody else's. In Britain, we demutualised our building societies, our very solid way of saving for a house and for a rainy day, and to be able to borrow with security. We demutualised them by people voting because they were being offered lump sum payments in order to create those building societies into banks, which were then swallowed up by other banks, which were then attempting to swallow banks elsewhere. One of our major banks went bust because they tried to buy a bank which was already going bust in Holland. And so it went on from one domino to another. But you can't get anybody to actually blame themselves for voting for demutualisation. I didn't actually vote for it, so of course I can cross myself and say how wonderful I was. It wasn't because my instinct told me that there was going to be a global meltdown. It was just because I actually like mutualisation. I like the idea of cooperative and social enterprise. I like people being able to share both in the benefits and in the risks together in an understandable and simple fashion. But we don't talk like that. We don't anymore in our politics in the UK say things simply enough for people to understand. So Gordon Brown holding the G20 in April in London, or playing a significant part in Chicago just a few weeks ago, has no resonance whatsoever with the bulk of the population who are worried about their jobs, their homes, their concerns about difference and diversity upsetting their traditional culture and their lives, or the fact that they think the world is going to hell in a handcart, and most of our newspapers tell them regularly that it is. Of course, as you know, those who tell others that politicians are all the same, that politics is a mess, that people really don't need to bother voting, understand perfectly well that politics makes a massive difference to their lives, and they go out and vote. Now, in Australia, you have compulsory voting, and I've come to the conclusion that we should have a debate in Britain. It's not purely altruistic, this, because Bob Worcester, who set up Moray, discovered recently from his polling that if there's a 52% turnout in our general election, David Cameron's Conservative Party will win with a majority of around 125. If there was a 70% turnout, God, I wish there would be, there would be a hung parliament. And if there was an 85% turnout, we'd win. So, you know, maybe wishful thinking. It seems to me to be suddenly a very good idea to have compulsory voting. But, I mean, the point I'm making is that, firstly, we haven't got a proper explanation of what's happened. Secondly, we haven't related it to people's lives. Thirdly, we haven't got a narrative about what we're trying to do and how we're trying to get out of it. And that is true of the French socialists, the Social Democrats in Germany, even the Social Democrats in Scandinavia. And I think that whilst Obama retains substantial popularity, partly because of his personality and his drive and the sheer magnitude of his achievement, actually, in the US, I think the Democrats would be wise to think about what is happening in politics across the world and the way people are reacting to the difficulties we face. My answer is to try and create a different sort of political system, where instead of saying to people, we will solve all your problems, we say, we will be an enabling government, supporting you in your own community, in your neighbourhood, at work, in your family and your life, to be able to help sort things together. So that we don't just have an agenda with a manifesto that attends to people, that we can wave a magic wand and put things right, but we try and reinforce civil society. We try and put the glue in by actually enabling people to feel that they can have a say in the things that are happening immediately around them, that we can use new technology to facilitate that. We can encourage people to come together, whether it's in simple ways, like volunteering, or whether it's in slightly more complex organisations in the charitable and voluntary sector, whether people can be brought in to decision making more readily at local government and, in your case, at state level, whether we can change the nature of public service delivery so that the consumer and user of services has a much greater say, so that we individualise budgets for personal care so that people can, with advocacy and support of course, buy what they would wish for themselves rather than what we're prepared to deliver to them. Can we create a political framework in which it isn't individualised consumerism, it isn't individualism and selfishness, but it's cooperation with an understanding that people require responsiveness and flexibility, and they want to say, and they want to be able to choose. And some of us are struggling to try and articulate that sort of agenda. When I talked to Tony Blair about it, and I still do, he said it, as someone who flirted quite heavily with communitarianism over the years, as I have, that the problem is that it all appears to be the soft underbelly of politics. It's not sharp edge, it's very difficult to rally people behind it. Vote for me and I won't deliver everything to you, but I'll help you sort it out for yourself. It's not not too rallying a cry, really. It's not what I made my political career on, as leader of Sheffield, banging the drum and facing down Margaret Thatcher and rallying people to a different sort of world. But actually, in the end, I think it will save our political democracy, because I fear Australia, you're not experiencing, I think, to the same degree, but I fear that we are on the edge of meltdown, not just in terms of our economy and our climate, but in terms of our democratic politics in places like the UK, where there is such disdain for the political process and such concern that politicians don't have answers and such worry about whether what we've traditionally offered can be sustainable, that we might actually end up pulling the house down around us. And that's why I've been very pleased to come tonight to stimulate a bit of debate and hopefully to hear from you whether you think Australia is miles and miles away from that, as well as miles and miles away from the United Kingdom. Thanks very much. Do you want to come on this side?
No, you stay there. I'm fine. Thanks for that. Now, if you just come back a little bit towards the centre here. Yeah, that's right. We've got the microphone there. Okay. So we come to questions and discussion. We get our speaker a glass of water. And I should say thanks to Mallesons for the use of this facility this evening, this great facility. Thank you, Stuart. And once again, thanks to Vanessa Clayton at Vision Australia, and working with Vision Australia and the Australia and New Zealand School of Government, who brought the Right Honourable David Blunkett to Australia, and I'm glad they did. So thanks for...
Well, I was hoping you were going to say that, because if you'd said, it's been an interesting evening, shall we all go home? Yeah.
So I'll start off. We've got plenty of time. Thanks for finishing on time. You spoke a bit about your background in Sheffield and in your left wing, as distinct from your social democratic background and leading the protests against Margaret Thatcher. But talk about your own political journey, because you... From there, you ended up in what was called New Labour, And as you will be aware, I mean, you raised the point about why attitudes are towards blaming left-to-centre parties. But as you well know, in Britain, one who drove a lot of the financial deregulation was Gordon Brown as Chancellor of the Exchequer, who actually praised what he called light-touch regulation, which led to some of the results which you've mentioned tonight. So explain your own journey from the radical at Sheffield to the prominent member in Tony Blair's new Labour administration.
I think my situation in Sheffield has to be understood within the context of what was happening to the city and to our country. I was elected actually as the right-wing candidate, so you can tell what my opponent was like in those days. We had 40% of our central government grant cut from the city. This is a city of just over 500,000. It's a traditional high-quality steel, high-quality engineering. It's not proletarian. It's a city built on craft and on skill. And we lost 50,000 jobs in steel and engineering alone. This is not counting all the people who lost their jobs on the back of that in 3 years. And the city was on the verge of collapse. And it was necessary, firstly, to pull people together and to reinforce the sense of belonging and identity. I unashamedly used the love of Sheffield to rally people who would otherwise never have voted for me to actually say, look, we've got to pull together, we've got to see this through, and we'll do it in new ways. We'll decentralise the delivery of services, we'll give tenants the right to choose what paint is used on their houses. These are simple things now. Looks nothing 25 years on. It was radical at the time. We'll create a bus service that everybody can use, the cheapest, the most efficient bus service in Britain that the Greater London Council emulated a few years later, but because of the way they did it, they fell foul of the courts. We were endeavouring to create mutual and cooperative and social enterprises to try and give people a feel that there was a possibility, the hope of a job, of using their skills in new ways. A lot of it, looking back, was like, you know, sort of spitting in the wind. It was a gesture rather than a major shift. But it did keep people's morale and motivation. And the one thing I learnt in, because we were facing two ways at once, we were facing the Thatcher government and saying we can't cope with the degree and speed of economic change and collapse that we're being faced with. We need to plan for this. And we were at the same time turning and facing down Arthur Scargill as the leader of the National Union of Mine Workers with their headquarters in my city. He actually threatened to take me to court. We backed the mining families to the hilt. My city was surrounded by mines. There are none of them left in South Yorkshire at all now. Just to get the scale of it, there were 240,000 miners in 1984. There are 3,000 now. So the change was enormous. And so I was facing two ways at once. What really changed my view of the way we had to operate was a recognition that globalisation was here to stay, that we were in a world, a transnational world, where global financial markets were going to affect us whether we closed our eyes metaphorically and pretended it was going to go away or not. And that's what affected Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who in their early days worked so closely together. And I think our deregulation was the result of two things. Firstly, a recognition that we were doing extremely well out of financial deregulation and the City of London, and bringing in billions of pounds in terms of hard currency and our trade balance. And secondly, almost wanting to put behind us the image of the Labour Party as a nostalgic bygone era party rather than the one that was modern, reforming, global, facing outwards. And we probably carried that too far in terms of failing to understand precisely what was happening with people taking deregulation themselves to be a license for them to print money.
Thanks. Before I call the next session, I should have also acknowledged David Blunkett's wife, Dr. Margaret Williams, who's here, and Gerard Mintz is from Vision Australia. So we move on. So where am I looking? Question here. Yeah.
Blunkett, I was wondering if you thought that maybe the media these days tends to run politics and people's thoughts. They work on sensationalism and working people up to a hysterical level about migrants or about crime on the streets, and they seem to run the agenda more than the politicians do, and that they seem to be in control of the public and the way the public thinks about politics.
2 points on that. Firstly, in a democracy, you can't ignore what people are absorbing, what they're feeling and thinking, and they're bound to be affected by what they read or see. And secondly, we probably overreact to that. I, until very recently, wrote a column in our most populous daily, The Sun, which of course is owned by Rupert Murdoch. I don't write anymore, and they don't support Labour anymore. The two probably go hand in hand. And I think we've exaggerated in our own mind the impact that they have. But just to give you one example of where this does affect us and where it matters, the Daily Express in Britain, which used to be a very popular newspaper, it's sort of fallen on, as most of our papers are now doing, fallen on harder times, but they increased their circulation by 20% on the day that they combined a major attack on immigration into the UK with falling house prices. This is going back about 8 years. And they literally saw a massive upsurge by the headlines they were able to put together. So you're entirely right that people are disquieted by what they read, but you're also right that we as politicians take account of it, because if we don't, then we're out. And we had an argument when I was the Home Secretary about whether my taking account of street crime and taking quite decisive action was actually causing people to be more concerned or less about the crime. I actually thought I was entirely right, otherwise I wouldn't have done it, because I think putting people's worries to bed is better than pretending that they're stupid and that they don't have these worries. But we had a serious debate inside government with people, officials from the Treasury, genuinely believing that if we kept quiet and we ignored it, it would somehow go away.
Yes.
Mr. Blunkett, I wanted to go back to immigration, which you've touched on a couple of times. In terms of Britain changing rapidly, one of the rapid changes seems to be the amount of demographic change and the impact of immigration in Great Britain. We're used to it here, but Britain probably has seen an enormous change over the nature of its people in the last 20 years. To what extent is some of the disgruntled feeling in the community that people are feeling Britain is changing too fast demographically, in terms of the kinds of people that are coming to Britain and the sorts of communities that are settling there?
Firstly, it's often the greatest disquiet, not in the areas of greatest diversity, where there are a massive plurality of ethnic origins, but immediately outside them. That's where the British National Party do best. It's in white working class communities, to use an old-fashioned phrase, where people think that they're about to be overwhelmed, where they see neighbourhoods close to them, where all the shops have changed, the food outlets have changed. Funnily enough, as the late Robin Cook, who was our Foreign Secretary, used to say, very strange, when chicken masala was probably one of their favourite dishes, but you know, they sort of didn't get the connection. And the uncertainty of whether it was taking jobs. Now, what's happening in Britain at the moment, of course, is that we, whilst we've got nowhere near the unemployment of France, Germany or Spain, we're now up to 8%. And when it was down at 3 and 4%, people were quite happy to see others filling jobs that they weren't interested in taking. As unemployment risen and as economic uncertainty has risen, that feeling that the world is changing too rapidly and that ethnicity is undermining their traditional way of life and what they were used to, that is taking its toll. And I'm quite clear in my own mind that we were right to, firstly, to allow properly managed migration, economic migration, with proper regulation. Secondly, that we were right to get tough on illegal entry into the country and unwarranted asylum, which we did, although you wouldn't believe it from reading our newspapers. And thirdly, that we didn't do enough in terms of working with communities that were integrating, that were seeking to integrate those from other backgrounds, faiths and cultures. And if we'd done more of that, then we'd be in a better position in the UK now to deal with those worries. We had, of course, alongside it, the European Union changes in 2004, where in the 27 countries, and of course we had the 10 new countries coming in, people were allowed to travel anywhere and to put roots down anywhere. In some of the European countries, they weren't allowed to work, so they just worked illegally. In places like Germany, they just worked in the sub-economy. It was my decision that we should allow people to work legally and we should register them. And that has caused me some heartache because people have said, well, that encouraged, you know, half of Poland to come to Britain and all this sort of stuff. Actually, what it meant was that we actually knew who was there. We know that many of them have gone back home. They sent remittances back to their country of origin. That increased their economic activity at home. It increased prosperity. It encouraged them to go back and to resettle. And that is happening. But it disquieted people in the sense that once again, you know, it was a Polish plumber. It was a Slovak waiter. It was someone else's accent. Someone else with a different background. And we've been... Given that we are what Daniel Defoe, four centuries ago, described as a mongrel nation, we've been pretty bad at dealing with the last 20 years of becoming slightly more mongrel than we were before.
Right, now there are a lot of questions. I think there are two down the back. So one,
do you want to take several and then people can comment, Gerald? All right.
No, well, let's go one at a time.
Okay, I'll try and be quicker on the answers.
No, but they can be quicker on the questions. Right. Andrew, you'll be very quick, and then we go one behind Andrew. Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Blunkett, for your presentation. I wanted to ask you quickly about your perceptions of how the right is responding to the politics today. It seems to me that in Britain, David Cameron is only prospering because he has, in fact, jettisoned most of Margaret Thatcher's views, particularly on economics. And we now have this emergence of the so-called red Tory tendency. I'm wondering if you could tell me, does this perhaps portend a return to kind of Harold Macmillan-style conservatism, big government conservatism, a conservatism that embraces progressive taxation?
Okay. A free kick on the Tories.
Well, no. The greatest tribute you can pay to Tony Blair is David Cameron, because... It was the shift in the whole political scene in the United Kingdom that has led to the Conservative Party. Bear in mind that David Cameron is, their fourth leader since 1997 to actually adapt and adopt a different stance. I believe their economic policy is muddled, but if they get in, they'll have to change it. Otherwise, we will be in free fall. But on other issues, they've pretty well gone to the centre and are being quick-footed, nimble-footed, and quick in terms of presentation, and it is making a difference.
Okay, right down the back. Quick question.
David, Australia is 10 years down the track from a referendum in 1999 to replace the Queen as head of state. You talk about the fact that politics is... for politics and potentially bringing things unstuck in England. Can you make a comment around the role that the monarchy might play in providing some glue and bring it back together?
Well, it can in Britain. I'm not sure about Australia. I'm on really dangerous ground here.
Yeah, I think so.
Just to say that in Britain, you wouldn't, you know, any politician who suggested that we should become a republic would be hung, drawn and quartered. My only sort of riposte to you is, if you do, and you will obviously at some point have another referendum, you've got to be pretty sure what you're putting in its place, that's all.
Stuart.
Mr. Blunkett, how would you describe the styles of Prime Ministers Blair and Brown in managing cabinet?
Well, Tony took the point of view that we shouldn't waste the whole of the day waffling to each other when actually we pretty much agreed and that he'd already tested the water before we got into cabinet. And that led the Permanent Secretary of the Cabinet, Robin Butler, to believe that we weren't actually following the constitutional traditions of going around the houses. I've read quite a lot since I left government in terms of autobiographies and diaries. And in the 1960s and 70s, they spent hours waffling about nothing. They had a two-hour debate in the Callaghan government about quotas for broiler hens from Denmark. And Tony cut through all this, as Margaret Thatcher did, by the way, and was clear, look, what is it we've got to do? Because he used to say look quite a lot. What is it we've got to decide? Who disagrees on this? If there is a disagreement, can we have a working cabinet committee on it? Can we meet? It suited, his style suited me very well, partly because he and I agreed so much, so if I wanted to get something through and I had his support, we got it through. And partly because I just think that politics gets in the way of, because of just talking and talking and talking, rather than identifying what needs to be decided, identifying the arguments around it, getting people together to discuss it, and then making a decision. And he once said that the worst sort of minister were those who won't make decisions. And politics is riddled with ministers who won't make decisions.
Right down the back, yeah.
Thanks very much, Mr. Blunkett. Just to take further your comments about Europe, how do you see Britain's attitude to Europe as a result of the what we call the GFC? I think you call it the Great Credit Crunch in the UK. We call it the Global Financial Crisis. Is it likely to lead to Britain severing ties with Europe or moving away from Europe or moving closer?
No, it isn't. What surprised me is that there's not been a greater recognition that as Europe we can have influence with the growth of China and India. You must debate this in Australia because of your some political geographic position. With the US, with China, with India, with Europe, we have some influence. As the UK offshore, we don't, even with our financial institutions in the City of London and our historic position. What's happened over the last 2 weeks is that the Czechs have now signed up to the Lisbon Treaty. And whilst this is, you know, completely mind-blowingly boring politics here, what's happened because of that is that that Lisbon Treaty has now solidified the new constitution within Europe and the new structural arrangements, and there's not a cat in hell's chance of the UK coming out of Europe or actually unwinding those constitutional changes. And David Cameron last week, before I left on Thursday and arrived here on Saturday, had just accepted that fait accompli. And in fact, I'd raised an issue of Prime Minister's questions last Wednesday about it, because he'd given a cast iron guarantee that there would be a referendum and that they would have no truck with the Lisbon Agreement. And as I pointed out, this appeared to have turned into plywood. Anyway, there we are. That's politics for you.
Right. So there's a question here. And a question here.
Thank you for your ideas, Mr. Blunkett. I appreciate, especially the idea that government should help people help themselves and aid people. Can you give some sort of flesh to the bones of that idea, though? How do you incentivise bureaucrats to help people help themselves?
Well, one of the big challenges of years to come, again, you're a young country, always been a young country, is we've got a massively ageing population. I mean, from the working population providing 10 workers to 1 in retirement 50 years ago. We're now down to 4-1. It will be 2-1 within the next 50 years. And we've got to develop our social care system based on family, based on people helping each other and volunteering, but also on social care where people have genuine choice, and therefore personalising the budget for support services is one step in that direction, so that you choose who you want to come into your home and help you. You choose, you have choice in terms of the flexible residential care for part of the time, or which day centre, or how you're going to operate in that fashion, rather than here is a service, take it or leave it. Now, it is very hard to operate that, and you also need support systems, because otherwise there'll be exploitation. We're doing it with people, for people with disabilities. We've got some way to go to make it really work so that people feel that they can choose. We have something called disability living allowance with mobility and attendance. People can choose how to use that allowance. It's not means tested, so it doesn't actually mean that you get disadvantaged by furthering your own self-help, getting a job, getting on, trying to work on equal terms. You don't get disadvantaged by it, and that's the sort of politics that I think we should be into.
Yes, changing the subject slightly, do you have a view on Turkey getting into the EU and whether that will happen?
Well, I agree with my own party that it would be a good thing to reach out to what is the only major secular Islamic state, and to give them an opportunity, as they have been doing, to change internally to be able to meet the requirements of the European Union. But the second part of your question is, I don't think there's a cat in hell's chance in the next 15 years that Turkey will get into the European Union, because the French and Germans are absolutely determined to stop them.
Is it the next 15 years? 1-5, 15?
1-5, yeah. I'm still working on a reasonable time scale.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end. There's a question there. Okay, we'll go there and then there. Yeah.
David, you mentioned the controversy in Britain over the National Front appearing in a television programme. Would you advocate giving a greater voice to extremist views, in that the person stands up and you prove yourself an idiot, or would you, do you agree with those who say that extremist views shouldn't be given a platform?
Well, on this particular issue, I have to accept that if they're elected, then their policies have to be reflected in the broadcast media, in our public service broadcast media, when they've got an argument to put. What I didn't agree with was the BBC actually making the presentation of the British National Party and their participation in Question Time a major feature of advertising their presence and that programme. I mean, they got an audience of 10 million, whereas they normally get an audience of 3 million now for that programme. They advertised it on every news broadcast. They spent the first 10 minutes of the 6 o'clock news that evening on BBC One television actually promoting the very thing that they'd created the controversy about. So in my view, the BBC behaved quite abominably, but not because they actually gave the right of BMP European Assembly members to have a voice heard, but the way in which they actually set about doing it.
I agree with that, and then, as you know, all the questions were really focused on the BNP rather than our talking about economic policy or social policy. It was all about the BNP, which was a
That's
huge
right.
promotion.
Absolutely.
I mean, they should have asked them what their economic
And on the programme itself, they didn't have a normal question time where a range of questions would have teased out the absurdity of the BNP's position. Instead, they concentrated wholly on that one individual. And in the end, the other downside of it was that for many people in a constituency like mine, he started to look like the underdog.
Yes.
And believe me, that is a dangerous position.
Everyone was against him. I think this will be... Yes, we've got a question here. We've got to be very quick. Yep.
Thank you again, sir, for a very incisive talk. Do you see any signs throughout, take it, the whole of the United Kingdom,
of jobs coming back and thus leading to a recovery?
We've had a much greater slowing of the rate of increased unemployment, if that's not a complete non sequitur, than anybody expected. The rate of growth of unemployment slowed dramatically. We think by the new year we'll be back into growth. We were amazed we weren't in this last quarter. And as a consequence, the impact on payments out for unemployment benefit and the impact on the slowdown in terms of people's optimism in looking to the future is beginning to turn around. What's happened in the UK is that people who have a job have been so worried by the way in which we have debated the downturn and we've dealt with it, that they don't go out and spend. Even people who are on tracker mortgages is where the mortgage is tied to our interest rates, and our interest rates have remained for 6 months at 0.5%. Even people who are better off aren't going out to restaurants and the theatre and shopping, and we've just desperately got to get them to do so. We tried by reducing our value-added tax by 2.5%. It's the only bit of our economic policy that I've got I've been worried about, because it's cost us this year £12 billion to reduce by 2.5% the value-added tax. It's going back on from the beginning of January. Nobody gave us a bit of credit when it came off. Believe me, they'll give us a lot of art to put it back on.
We can be very quick here.
A quick question. You talked about Sheffield and its loss of its mining jobs, and you talked about the ageing of the population. Can you just give us a brief picture of what is the economic and social life of Sheffield like today?
Well, it's quite vibrant, mainly because of the tremendous strides that occurred when I was leader of Sheffield. We rely very heavily now on the service sector, on our two major universities, the development of health technology around the university sector, on sport and leisure, and on developing information technology. We are trying to find a new niche. Sheffield was known for cutlery, for silverware, for steel and engineering. I'd like in 10 years to be able to tell you what it is that Sheffield is known for. At the moment, I still can't. Apart from extremely warm hearts, generous people, and I love them greatly.
And your own intentions are the next.
And I heard you say that, and it's because I support a football club called Sheffield Wednesday, and the other club, Sheffield United, used to host the cricket, and now they don't. Yorkshire's gone downhill ever since.
And your own intentions at the general election?
I'm stunning again. I'm one of the very few people, thank the Lord, who's not been affected by the terrible upheaval and scandal about allowances. I mean, a lot of it was not a scandal. Some of it was. It's caused, I think, probably half our parliament will be different after the general election. Half our parliament. And some of us are bloody-minded enough to decide, because I've got a full pension. I could leave and go to the House of Lords as ex-Home Secretary. I just think I have an obligation both to my own community and to my party to actually stick it out and be there afterwards, whether we win or lose, and try and help to see it through. The one thing I'm absolutely certain about is some of us are going to have to be there to fight to ensure that my party doesn't go back to the old days, that's all.
Thank you very much. Just stay there, don't you? I mean, thanks for a wonderful presentation tonight, which has been so full of ideas, but also a lot of information for those of us, and most of us in Australia are very interested in Britain, so thanks for that. I've always been a great admirer of David Blunkett. I very much admired the work that he did as Home Secretary in Britain, and watched it with great interest in Australia. He was one of these politicians. There are a few of them around. There are not a lot of them around who speak their mind and say it as they see it, and that's pretty important. You know where David Blunkett is coming from, and he was a courageous Home Minister and stood up for what I thought he should have stood up for. So congratulations for a fine performance tonight. I'd love you to come back to Australia in the future, and we'd love to have you back for Sydney Institute, but I'd also like to
extend good wishes for next year, the general election.
Thank you very much indeed. That's very kind.
Okay.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.